afternoon. So last time, we were looking at a bunch of ways of doing bounds checking and sort of comparing what they could actually do. So we had, you know, all these proposals which were designed around, well, we're starting with some C code that forgot to do bounds checking, or we think may have forgotten to do bounds checking, and we want to sort of fix that. And we actually saw like kind of two different philosophies that kind of very much affected the kinds of solutions that we were looking at. So one was there's some people who said, well, my goal is to run the program such that buffer overflows don't cause any problems. And the other is my goal is to help people find buffer overflows. And we saw that we had different solutions in those two spaces. So the baggy bounds checking idea, they were saying, we just want to prevent buffer overflows from being bad. So we're not going to be worried about like precisely figuring out when you go out of bounds. In fact, we're going to make that way harder to do because we're not going to track exact object sizes to make our scheme efficient. Versus the address sanitizer is a debugging tool, so it sort of gets kind of exact precision for each byte of memory, and the mechanism it uses to do that kind of lets us skip over these things in spaces in between objects, which is how it's detecting the actual overflows, which meant that as a security mechanism, address sanitizer certainly will prevent kind of our buffer overflows that are contiguous, where we start in the buffer and then go outside of it, but won't prevent our ones which are kind of a index computation that's exploitable, like something like an integer overflow, where we don't compute the correct size. We don't compute an index that is starting in the correct place, so we can skip over these quote-unquote red zones, these sort of areas that are marked as inaccessible. And we also saw, like, combined with this philosophy, we had a difference in whether we were doing the checking on pointer to reference or pointer arithmetic, both in terms of what instrumentation we had to do and kind of the complexity of our solution. And one of the big advantages of checking on dereference was this thing which comes up all the time when we talk about making some sort of programs hardening tool, which is compatibility with, and in this case, binary compatibility. If we want to use existing libraries, the approach that fat pointers used and baggy bounds used are kind of sketchy. They don't like work great with existing libraries. The fat pointers one, especially not, because we can't have bounds information for an external pointer. We can't pass it to an external pointer. And for the baggy bounds, well, the pointers can at least look normal. And we can replace malloc, so that's pretty good, but the code that sort of another library uses might put things on the stack which won't follow the rules that we follow for our allocations to have them have a trackable size. And we saw this bigger issue, which is that, you know, if we're doing instrumentation where we sort of say, okay, what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna change malloc. So malloc tracks the size of the object and makes sure we stay in that allocation. Great idea, right? Because we saw that overflows from one object to another, you know, kind of this nice generic thing that's exploitable. And we can think of similar things for allocating on the stack. That, oh, I'm just going to make sure that when we have a variable on the stack, that accesses to that variable don't go outside it. The problem is that this kind of ignores that a non-trivial amount of the time will have some complex structure on the heap or on the stack, and we'll have an overflow within that. That's kind of out of scope for all but the fat pointers version of this tool, because they just discarded that information that we needed to actually track. You know, are we accessing part of a value or the whole thing? Which is kind of important. Questions on things we covered last time? Okay, so the challenge assignment is released So on Canvas under files, there are some solutions to some prior homeworks, and also the challenge executables and some supporting files. As I mentioned, the format is a little different than the prior assignments in that we specify an output file rather than writing a standard out. But you're going to submit an attack for any five. If you submit more than five, we'll take the best five. Though probably if you're, you'll know which ones are best. And as is mentioned in the challenge assignment, we're not going to guide you on the specifics of solving a challenge solution. So, we'll definitely be able to talk specifically about, say, a past homework that you might think is similar, and that would be kind of how we can give you more specific help, since we're not going to sell you, you need to put the ROP chain exactly here. It's not going to be information I or our TA is going to tell you. But we can certainly go through and give the answer for, say, how you were supposed to do that on the homework or other similar examples and other things like that. And I guess probably a big part of the challenge assignment is that it is your job to figure out what exploit technique is applicable to each one. In some cases, there are some hints, or there's something from the structure that might be clear, but that's your job to figure out. We're not going to just tell you what to do. As far as that, and some of them, there might be multiple applicable techniques, and that's, if you can find one which works, that's fine. So questions on the challenge. Okay, and as is on the schedule, the challenge is due the last day of classes. Yes?
The assignment says the time of written
final. Time of what?
Written final.
Oh. That is me not updating things. So I mean it to be due. Did I actually make that inconsistent? Yeah, and the schedule page. I meant to have it be due is due the last day of classes. I'll change that to that, and I'll probably because I want time to grade it. And that matches what's on the schedule on the submission site. My intention is that, but that means the normal weight policy doesn't apply to it.
So, due on the last day of classes, but we do get the
but you do get the late policy 90% for 72 hours. Rather than as was originally written, where we had a tight final. Yes. Yeah, I forgot to check carefully that I have written that in the assignment. Yeah, but just have it as a normal assignment, and I'll make an announcement about that, I guess. Thank you for pointing that out. Challenge. And on our this question from last time, I made some slides that should go over the answer specifically, since I know what I wrote. Okay, so our main topic for today, we're going to talk about something called control flow integrity. And we're going to start with the idea of sort of getting beyond what stack canaries do and having something that should be better than stack canaries. And an intuition we might have is that the problem is that we don't really check where the return address goes. And stack canaries kind of indirectly try to check where the return address goes, that it goes to the same place we were called from. But we can have this alternate idea of, why don't we just make sure that we're returning to some place that called this function? So an idea we might have is that, you know, whatever we're about to return, we look at the return address, and we inspect the code just before there, and make sure it's a call to this function. Now, this seems a little annoying because there's lots of ways of calling functions. So it's kind of hard to know, you know, if the correct function, you know, is being, you know, called, with, because we need like a general disassembler to like figure out all the types of calls. So a more practical idea is that when we're writing the code to call functions, we choose a label for the function, and we insert an instruction containing that label afterwards. And you might say, well, there's no label instruction. We can just use an instruction that does nothing, that has a space for a constant in it. And it's pretty common that there's variants of no-ops where there's some things we can change in the no-op, so we can use that as our label. And then when we're actually, you know, running our function, we say get the return address, take the return address plus 2, that's where the label is in this instruction hypothetically, make sure it matches the value we chose, and if not, crash. Okay, so kind of like stack canaries, but rather than looking for a value on the stack, we're looking for a value where we're returning to. And you'd imagine in this scheme, like our compiler would be modified to figure out the label for each function and annotate our calls in this way. So questions on this kind of labeling scheme I have here. So this obviously kind of looks like stack canary. So what is something this prevents that stack canaries don't, or vice versa? So who thinks this is better than stack canaries? Thinks this is worse than stack canaries? People. Who thinks this is sometimes mostly better, but sometimes worse? Or, okay. Mostly worse, but sometimes better? Okay. No opinion? No clue? So, some of that. So, any ideas for what would be sort of examples of how useful this is differs from stack canaries? Any thing people can think of, something that makes this better, more or less useful than just using a stack canary? So back there, yeah. So the question, if we have any 2-byte opcode and any 4-byte constant, the check would just go through? The idea of this scheme is that we choose this number, and this is hard-coded in foo, right? So, and foo might be a vulnerable function with a stack overflow. we can replace the return address. And this, our call to foo has to match that, is the idea. So it's not just any constant, we choose a number. So in this scheme, our compiler would choose a number for foo. That is the label we're going to use every time. And as like here, like we're probably basically essentially choosing a random 32-bit number. So it's unlikely to appear by accident elsewhere. And this is kind of similar to stack canaries. We basically chose a random number. Yeah?
Is it randomized at the same time as stack canaries?
So, question, is this randomized at the same time as stack canaries? No. So this would be hard-coded in the executable. So we're going to produce our executable. We're not going to change it each time. We're just going to choose a number when we compile. Yeah?
So, like, supposing I did, like, the buffer overflow to try to, like, overwrite that, I should just read through the program, find the label of the function that I want to exploit, copy it, and include that in my overflow?
So the question is, could we just copy this and include this in our overflow? So our idea is that we have our function foo, it has a stack, and we have our return address, right, that points to initially to this, just after this call to foo, and we have the label here. Does that make sense? So that's, and then we have a buffer here. And our buffer overflow overwrites the return address here. Then in foo, we're going to have our code which pops. Yes, this is the return address goes into RDX, and then compare to RDX, and this is does blank equal memory at RDX plus 2. And normally what this will do, right, if we don't have a buffer overflow, this is going to be comparing this value from the instruction where we recalled. Let's say we do a buffer overflow here. Then in that case, our proposal is we're going to make this return address point somewhere else. And what's your proposal on where it points?
Well, like, if I wanted, just thinking if we wanted to get to foo some other way that, like, would not, like, if.
Okay, let's talk about your idea that, if this is just static, we can just read the code. And, yeah, so let's say we're doing our classic stack smashing where we return to our buffer. In that case, I can make sure my buffer has a copy of this instruction, and I have solved nothing. And unlike our stack canaries, you know, we didn't actually make this attack really any harder. If I have a copy of the executable, I can run this attack with stack canaries. I need an information leak at runtime. And control flow integrity is using this technique with the idea that we're gonna have a different way of mitigating this type of buffer overflow. So who can guess what different way the people using CFI want to use to prevent us from doing stack smashing? If we're not doing it with stack canaries. Something else which made this type of attack not work. That's actually very common. Very low overhead. Yeah. ASLR, that does do that. We're not going to even assume ASLR. But yes, ASLR would make this require another information leak like stack canaries, so we might say, okay. But there's something that even if we have an information leak, would make this hard, make this not work. That we could, some other mitigation we've talked about in the semester. And a mitigation that's simpler to implement most of the time than ASL. Okay, so this working relies on us executing code here. And we can set memory as not executable. So the assumption the CFI people are going to make is that we don't have executable memory that is also writable. So they're relying on us sort of doing that first step, which indeed hasn't always been done. But we're assuming we do that because otherwise, yeah, there's this trivial workaround where we just write shellcode that includes the label and say, yes, this is a valid place to call foo from. So that's a first workaround we're going to do. So what was our fix for having not for memory not being executable? What do we do to work around that as an exploiter? This was an assignment, yes?
Open a shell.
So we ended up opening a shell. How did we do that? Yeah. Yeah, ROP, right? So we would instead, so we did ROP chain, where instead of returning there, we return to existing code. So this is where making it hard to make valid ROP chains is where this technique really shines. That it's really, really unlikely we're going to have a gadget that is accidentally labeled correctly. And our first gadget needs to have the correct label, or else we won't go there. So this idea really limits, you know, where we can go. So assuming we have all writable memory be non-executable, if we don't do that, this technique is very ineffective, then we can't write new places for return addresses to go. And also, you know, most of these sort of random places we use for ROP won't be valid anymore. Because we can't actually just return anywhere. We can only return to places with the correct label. It also avoids kind of a flavor of attacks where we mess up, where we keep the existing stack and return to a different, and like move the stack pointer in the real stack to confuse the program behavior. Like that will generally not work. So, no. So the other thing is that it prevents different type of attacks than stack canaries do. So stack canaries are basically trying to check, they aren't reliable at this because of information leak, but they're trying to check that the return address hasn't changed. This is just checking that the return address is valid. So let's say I have two functions that call sortList, and while the sort, and let's say there's a buffer overflow affecting the comparator that sortList uses. In that case, the attacker can redirect execution from innocent to dangerous by changing the return address of shortlist. They have an appropriate vulnerability, like a point receptorfuge type memory write, or just a stack overflow and they just write valid stuff, a valid sequence of things. but then including a return to the wrong function. What that's going to check is valid, because that's a valid place for sortlist to return to. And this means that it's actually really hard to reason about whether this defense like actually prevents the attacker from doing things. We have a similar sort of problem that we have a bunch of things the attacker could run. It's a much smaller number than ROP chains, so we're not as concerned as we are with ROP chains. But it's still actually hard to look at a program and say, does this actually make the overflows unexploitable? Not necessarily. And this is something where stack canaries kind of deal with the problem. So another issue that I don't know, thought I had a slide for, but I don't, is let's say I have a function, bar, that does some stuff, and then returns to foo. Returns what foo returns for something, or, foo of some x, let's say. So in this scheme, how are we going to write the assembly for this, right? We're going to have, so the simplest way is we move x into RDI, we call foo, and if we aren't worrying about this control flow integrity stuff, that would be what the assembly looks like. And then we return, right? That makes sense. Compilers want to optimize this assembly. What's the optimized version of this look like? Someone have an idea? So what is inefficient about what we're doing here? Yeah.
I don't know if this is super inefficient, but you're calling out a function then just to immediately return twice.
Okay.
You could have foo
return
to R's return
after this. Yeah, so we're calling just to return afterwards. We could just have foo return directly to where we need to go, right? So this is an optimization we would like to do, is change this code to set RDI and jump to foo. And if foo is going to return, it's going to go here. This is pretty problematic with that control flow integrity labeling scheme I talked about. And this is called, this optimization, you'll see it referred to as a tail call optimization. And it's one compilers really like doing. It's very useful for some recursive functions where it might keep us from overflowing the stack. But this doesn't work with control flow integrity without a bunch of extra work, because it would seem that then we need to have, we'd have our label here, but we can't put our label there, because that's not where foo is going to look. So our options for dealing with this are either we need to have the same label for bar and foo, or we need to not do this optimization when calling foo. Questions about this tail call issue? So, I think she doesn't. So, I applied this to kind of normal function calls, but there's an issue. There's also other types of function calls which also seem problematic. So, what if we call a function through a pointer? And one example we have of that is if we have sort of polymorphism. Remember, we have these V tables. So how do we check a call to the bar method of an A object, which could be calling the bar method in A, or it could be calling it one of its subclasses? So So what we need to do there so I guess there's two things you want to check. So there's two issues here. So one issue is that when this bar method returns, well, we have to use the same label, just like I talked to you earlier, for its call. So if we're adding our integrity, we need our integrity to this call here, I want to do one label here. The other thing we want to do, though, is this is another thing like our return that's a control flow transfer that we want to check. So here's where we're going to go well beyond what stack canaries do. So stack canaries, we could just check returns. We're also going to check that this vtable entry is genuine. And a way we can do that is we can apply the same strategy we did for our returns, that we're going to look at where we're calling and make sure it's labeled appropriately. So we can have our compiler say that the bar method of A has this label, and every implementation of that method has to have that label. And before we actually do the vtable call, we make sure the label's there. And if it's not there, we say, nope, not going to run this method. And if you remember, when we had kind of a usual vtable override, if we couldn't have executable writable memory, we looked for a gadget in the program to run, or a function in the program to run instead of the normal method. In this case, that's not going to have the right label, because we'll choose a unique label for each kind of superclass method. And we'll also, as I mentioned, you know, have a check for our return in the same manner. So basically, every time we have one of these kind of computed jumps, we're going to add a label to say, is it okay? So questions about this kind of labeling idea? So we've applied this to returns and to vtable calls. And we also want to apply it to kind of every other way we have kind of one of these kind of function pointer type control transfers, or pointer to code. And some of these cases are kind of challenging. So if my sort function takes a comparison function, then we have to kind of mark, you know, that that's a safe place to call it. But we don't want the comparison code, you know, we don't want this fork sort code to just call any old function. Right? You only want it to call safe comparison functions, so if there's an overflow that overwrites that comparison function setting, it doesn't work. And we'd like to apply the same strategy to this, so what we'll do is try to label all the compare functions. How do we do that? So this is where we're getting into things that are kind of expensive and sketchy. So the people who've deployed this technique, you know, we try to do some analysis of the program to say, what are all the pointers that could possibly be passed to this compare function? Remember when we talked about the static analysis idea of, like, for each variable, let's just track the set of all possible values for each direction we could go. That's usually the type of analysis they'll do. They'll say, can we get the set of all things that for every call to sort function in the program that it could be sent to? And again, we're going to have another version of, of this problem. Right, that we're going to allow the wrong call. Because we're just restricting the calls based on kind of the immediate context, you know, we can allow you to call the wrong thing. So we have this version where we're returning to the wrong place. If we think of the vtable case, I could have a A object, but end up calling, if an attacker overwrites the vtable entry, the B bar method. And whether that's dangerous or not obviously depends on context, but we could imagine cases where it's like, you know, the file accessing A and the memory accessing A, and these might be very, very different. And that might be a concern. But this is an idea people have, and people, you know, said, okay, so this seems like something we can do to programs, and with compiler techniques, we can kind of assign all these labels and add them to programs. And in cases where we can't, like, set the label precisely, we can just kind of say, well, I'll just have a label that's too broad, right? So the simplest version we could use, which we'll talk about later, is we could just, like, have, you know, the label be a random number, and that would still be better than our status quo, because this would mean that we couldn't jump to the middle of code, which is precisely what we were usually doing in return-oriented programming, right? We'd have to jump to places that functions actually return to, or beginnings of functions. So we can always kind of have too many things with the same label, and it's still better than if we don't do this technique at all. But ideally, we have like kind of different labels for every single case. So people like actually applied this technique, and there's, you know, even an implementation that we sometimes use with Clang and is sometimes used. And it has not horrible overhead. The original implementation, the Clang's implementation, does some other checks and also lets you selectively enable, do you want to do it for returns, for bTable calls or not? Like, you can just set specific things you want to check against. And it has actually kind of reasonable overhead. So you might say, why don't we just turn this on all the time? There's some problems. So one issue is that, like, we need to worry, we have this problem, and we need to, like, actually figure out labels for cases like this. And basically what we're doing to assign labels is we actually need to kind of look at kind of what are the possible ways that functions can go, and we need to look at, well, what are the ways we can get to a specific case? And, you know, we have this issue, if we think of our comparison functions and their returns, right? That we need to figure out not only what are all the comparison functions, we also need to figure out what are all the places the comparison functions can return to, and we need to assign them all the same label. So in this case, there's only one, but right, if we imagine having other sort functions, you can imagine, or other functions that do compare. So if we had a select nth, right, that used a compare function, we'd have the same label there. And we have to do this kind of program-wide analysis to actually do it. And what we're dealing with is what compiler people call a control flow graph. We have this graph in the DSA2 sense, of where the nodes are blocks of code, and the edges are ways we can go from one block of code to the other. And basically, we're just trying to set a label on, you know, so that things match up. And make sure every time you have an edge to a node, that everything is checking for that same label each time. And where this gets kind of annoying is that, like, for this code, right, it's actually, like, I have the control flow graph for this code from this example from the original CFI paper. And getting this control flow graph is very mechanical, but it's not super trivial. So the compiler's doing a bunch of work. But where this gets annoying is that this kind of implies we have all the code. And very commonly, we don't have all the code. So let's say I'm using libpng, PNG library. If I think of what my control flow graph looks like, very commonly, we will have that involve calls to and from a library. So in this example, I am calling libpng a bunch. So if we wanted to use this control flow integrity technique, we'd somehow have to choose a label for here, have it be checked properly here. We need to choose a label for here and have it be checked properly here. And need to consider all the possibilities for that. And this is even though, like the way we typically compile this program, this is in libpng.so. That's a real problem. And the Clang implementation solution is you have to statically link. Big disadvantage. And the other thing is that when we're doing this analysis, it's not going to be precise. Right. So if we're thinking of what the compiler is doing, the compiler isn't running the code to see what can actually happen. It's sort of looking at what's possible without that knowledge. So it might be the case, for example, that there is absolutely no way for this to call function B. But the compiler is going to have to assume that that's possible unless it can actually solve what all these if conditions do. And you might say, well, why can't it do that? If you want like kind of a trivial argument of why the compiler won't do that, you could imagine that all these if conditions might involve cryptography. You know, we aren't going to claim a compiler is going to like reverse a hash function. Some questions? So another problem we have with this technique is that we can have calls to non-overlapping sets of functions. So what should we do here if we want to So we're starting protecting this call through a function pointer. Right, so I've determined that from foo we can call A or C, and from bar we can call B or C. What should I do about this case as far as making sure that we verify the label on P correctly? Any proposals? So the issue here is I need to put something in this question mark. So let's start with what is something I can put in those question marks to make this work? As in, the code will be functional. Yeah, so the simplest solution is we just choose the same label for all these cases. But you can see that this is kind of unsatisfying because I have this extra information about what foo and bar are supposed to be able to call. And we can imagine this gets really ugly if I have more than two functions that are doing this. But it's probably still advantageous because we know in a sense that all the functions here must be compatible in some way. So we're at least, you know, we don't expect everything to end up with the same label. So that's one solution, is we just find the same label, but now we have kind of an exaggerated version of this problem, right? Now there's going to be kind of non-obvious extra calls we're going to allow because we couldn't label things precisely. So another strategy we can use is that we can you know, we can change this check to check for multiple labels and assign different labels. But obviously that's taking what was, you know, a kind of cheap thing to do, like comparable to stack canaries, and you can quickly imagine that kind of growing out of proportion. So those are questions about this. So as I mentioned, Clang has this actual implementation of control flow integrity, at least that was at one point used for some things. It doesn't handle the return stuff. And you might say, why not? Probably just because they think, well, we have stack canaries, and we have other sort of hardware-assisted mitigations. One of which we talked about is hardware support for shadow stacks, if you care about this stuff, you might try to enable. And there's some other more modern mitigations we'll probably talk about next time. So they focus on vtables and function pointers. And you have to compile all the libraries you use in your program with support for this in order to use it. And since we're just protecting kind of function pointers and vtables, they don't use the strategy that we showed you in sort of kind of the original implementation of modifying the machine code. Instead, we have this kind of data structure on the side, which we can look up the function pointer or vtable address in. So basically, instead of having our labels here, we're going to have a hash table. Not really a hash, something like a hash table, where we look up A, and that gives us, you know, this value here, and we look up B, and that gives us this value here, and so on. Some sort of table like that. And to make this sort of lookup efficient, we could do this with a hash table, but that seems a little sketchy. If every time we call a polymorph method, a method which could be overridden by inheritance, now we add a hash table lookup for that. That would be pretty sketchy, pretty bad for performance. So Clang does this kind of trick where they kind of carefully arrange the program's memory to make these checks fast. And I think I'll consider myself out of time, so we'll talk about that next time. And my plan is to talk a bit about something related to control flow. So talk a little more about control flow integrity, and then talk a little about authenticated pointers, which are kind of like control flow integrity, and are actually used on modern ARM systems. So.